Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, a new draft for a ceasefire resolution between Israel and Hezbollah militants is circulating today. We'll have more from the UN later in the program. But first, the Bush administration is considering tapping into the Strategic Petroleum Reserves following disruptions in the U.S. crude oil supply in Alaska's Prudhoe Bay, the largest oil field in the nation. The oil company BP shut down the field after finding a leak and evidence of corrosion in the pipelines. Company officials apologized, saying production will be down by about 400,000 barrels a day, or almost 8% of U.S. petroleum production, and also they have no idea how long the field will be offline. News of the shutdown sent oil prices up this morning, so what will the effect be at the pump? Joining us is Vahan Janjigian, editor of Forbes Growth Investor. Vahan, how significant is this disruption to you? 400,000 barrels sounds like a lot.
Well, you know, normally I would say that it's really not that big of a deal. The problem is that the oil markets right now are so tight that this comes at such a bad time because of all the problems going on in the rest of the world with the oil-producing nations such as Iran, Nigeria, Venezuela, Iraq. So it comes at a very bad time, and it certainly has the effect of pushing up prices.
And you left out the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah militants. I'm assuming that has some impact.
Well, of course, neither Israel nor Lebanon exports any oil. However, the big threat there is that Iran in particular has threatened to retaliate if Israel, for example, were to attack Syria or to escalate the fighting any further. And one way Iran might retaliate is to significantly restrict the flow of oil through the Persian Gulf, through the Straits of Hormuz, and that would have a huge impact on prices.
Well, we all remember how Hurricane Katrina caused a spike in oil prices last year, right about at this time, and now we're right in the middle of a new hurricane season. Is that having an impact, or at least pressure of anticipation on oil prices?
Well, you know, so far, I would say no. In fact, recently we heard that the expectation is that the hurricanes this summer should be less severe than last summer. But yeah, certainly any time there's a tropical storm that threatens to make its way into the Gulf, you will see prices go up.
Well, as we said, the U.S. government says they're preparing to open up the Strategic Petroleum Reserves if needed. Briefly remind us, what are they? And is this, in your mind, a great enough emergency to demand that measure?
Well, yeah, to answer your second question, I do think it is a great enough emergency to release some oil if need be. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve currently has close to 700 million barrels of oil in it. The problem is that once the president decides to release oil, it typically takes about 13 days before that oil reaches the market. So if he's going to do it, he should certainly do it soon. There's plenty of oil there to give some relief to the markets. Now, it's not just the SPR, however. OPEC has also announced that they are willing to increase production. Saudi Arabia in particular is already producing about 9 million barrels a day, and it does have some excess capacity, and it could, if it wanted to, increase production by about 2 million barrels per day.
And then again, politics might come into play there. But the oil company BP already had problems in Alaska. Earlier this year, there was a major oil spill at the same oil field. They're facing a criminal investigation over that incident. And now this leaky corrosive pipe that BP officials found in a routine investigation, it seems. BP, the largest oil producer in the U.S., is the company in trouble?
Yes, Robin, you know, that's a very good point. They had a major spill last March. That resulted in them increasing inspections, and in June they found some corrosion, and they shut down a stretch of pipeline that took about 23,000 barrels a day of production off the market. They've had other problems in the past with oil spills. They also had an explosion in a refinery in Texas that killed about 15 workers. So, yeah, they've been having quite a bit of problems, and I would say they're in trouble.
And the markets, will they be reacting to that as well?
Well, yeah, they could. They could react to that. Now, whether this affects BP's profits or not is a different question because, of course, you know, one effect is that oil prices are going higher, so the company's bottom line probably will not be affected by the lack of production or the decrease in production. However, I think you could see some major fines and some criminal prosecutions.
Right. Well, briefly, Vahan, the company's bottom lines might not change, and yet the price of oil is going up. And so the question question is, how much might this affect the prices at the pump? And in just the few seconds we have.
You know, that really depends on how quickly oil from the SPR hits the market and if OPEC really does increase production. But, you know, let's assume oil prices go up to $80 per barrel in the short term. I mean, we could see an additional 20 cents per gallon to the price of gasoline.
That's Vahan Janjigian, editor of Forbes Growth Investor, talking to us about the effects of the shutdown of a major oil field in Alaska on oil and gas prices. Vahan, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we want to switch now for a few minutes to a topic on the minds of many going off to college or spending the next year trying to pick one. A new book attempts to be the complete guide to the college experience. It's written by Robert H. Miller, a graduate of Yale University and Pennsylvania Law School, and he wrote it with a team of recent college grads. Rob is also the previous author of The Law School Confidential and co-author of The Business and Med School Confidential. His new book, Campus Confidential, The Complete Guide to the College Experience by Students, for students. Rob, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a huge book, and it's one that you hope people use throughout their college, maybe post-college grad school experience. But let's start in the beginning and just get some information out. You know, choosing a college. Tick off some of the criteria. I know one-size school is one, for instance.
Yeah, there actually is a section, a whole chapter in the book called The Relevance Calculus, which is a creation that we put together in the law school book. And have carried through to this one, that lists 119 different factors in choosing a school.
It's amazing. It's everything from how much financial aid the school gives, how diverse it is, to whether or not the washing machines work. And when you wash your clothes, I mean, you ask a student that, and then you calculate how well the school does in that category and then add it all up. I mean, it's a lot of work.
It is, but the key to it is that the whole approach is it asks applicants and people considering college admission to put their interests first. You know, what I'm trying to do is get people away from the current trend, which is to open up U.S. News and World Report, go to the top bunch of schools and say, which of these schools could I possibly get into, and just apply to those. You know, you have to ask yourself, if I got into the number one school in this list, do I really want to go there? And so the question is, you know, of these schools, which are right for you?
Right.
And that's the analysis you have to undertake first, I think.
Well, then, once you've done that, there's the application process. You've got all sorts of tidbits, you and your team, of advice. One, I love, no such thing as an optional essay. It's only optional for people who don't want to get into this school. So never believe them when they say the essay is optional in the application process. But what else, you know, some other tips when you're applying for college?
One of the big ones that I think is very important is the on-campus interview. I'm always amazed when I ask people, have you had an on-campus interview? And they look at me with like a blank stare and they say, no.
Well, what happens? I mean, are you told that there's one or do you have to ask? I mean,
most schools offer them. And they're usually offered by members of the admissions committee or upperclassmen, juniors and seniors, who are very well versed in the admissions criteria and whose decisions matter a lot in your candidacy.
I was going to say, since you do these interviews, how much of a percentage do you think it's worth?
Well, it varies from school to school,
right.
But there's a distinction between the on-campus interview and the what's called the alumni interview. The alumni interview, you write a report and it goes in the file and it gets discussed in the way that your essay gets discussed and it gets a grade the same way. But the on-campus interview is such an important opportunity if you can get one. And it's like, you know, tickets to a concert. When the date comes that these interviews start to be given out, the admissions office gets flooded with requests and the interviews get filled and there are only so many slots. And if you don't get one, you're out of luck.
So make sure you're right in the front.
That's one of the very important bits of advice that we give. If you can identify three or four schools that you're really interested in attending, make every effort to get down there and get a face-to-face.
And yet, for some, that might not be the best idea. I mean, what are some ways you can blow that interview?
Well, I think one of the biggest ways to blow an interview is to show up and ask questions that are just obvious from the promotional materials for the school. How many students are there? How important are the fraternities and sororities? Those kinds of questions can be answered from a website or a promotional video or the course catalog. What you really ought to be doing in that interview is going in with a set of two or three points that you want to make to give some skin and bones or some flesh to your application and sell yourself. You know, make a case why you as an individual should get the slot that so many other people want. A well-done interview that makes the interviewer either stay longer than your allotted time or complete the interview and kind of have this wow moment where they want you as opposed to having you get away and go somewhere else because they see something special in you. That's such an important opportunity. In the world today of admissions where these slots are so competitive, every little opportunity that you can give yourself matters. So, and these are all little incremental things, but they're so important.
So, Rob Miller, since you've and your team, you've sifted through everything, you told us what not to say in one of these interviews. Just frame a statement or a question that an interviewee should say.
For one thing, if you could identify a particular area of interest that you were compelled to study, and it wasn't clear to you from the materials or a campus visit or one of the videos that's mm-hmm. available, whether or not you could, for example, design a double major. Let's say that you're interested in psychology and law, but there's no law undergraduate major, but you wanted to study psychology and law and have that be a component of your mm-hmm. psychology major. Would it be possible to design a curriculum for mm-hmm. yourself, or is that foreclosed? And at some schools, the answer would be yes, it's foreclosed, and at other schools, it would be no.
And in just about every interview, the interviewer would say, wow, this is a real go-getter. They want a double major.
And this is somebody who's done their homework and knows that we have a good psychology department, knows that we don't have an undergraduate major in pre-law or whatever.
Got it.
But somebody that wants to explore those things.
Got it. Okay, so let's move on because the book does move through all these processes. We'll get to the next one, which is funding. Just tick off some of the resources of funding that you think are overlooked.
I think the most overlooked source of funding is the vast number of scholarships that are available. Some are need-based, but a ton of them are not. Mm. They're given out by community organizations, by national organizations, by regional organizations. There are websites and books that collect these different sources. And I was shocked to learn when doing the research for the book that many of these sources are unable to give out their money every year because they don't have any applicants.
Yeah, that was surprising to read. And here's, by the way, some of the websites, fineaid.com, that's a financial aid calculator. AbsolutelyScholarships.com offers a searchable database of 10,000 scholarships. I mean, there's just tons of search engines.
There are a lot of search engines, and there are a couple of very good books that are out available in bookstores that people can get just collecting lists of these. And all you need is a little bit of time and a little bit of initiative. And you go out and make applications to these, and some of them are 500 or 1,000. Some of them are up to 10 or even a full boat in some cases. And, you know, you start to collect some of these, and it starts to become real money.
Robert Miller is author of Campus Confidential. We talked to him about, getting into schools, doing your relevance calculus, asking questions like what's the faculty-to-student ratio, what's the average class size, what's the prevalence of alcohol on campus, and then, as we just said, paying for schools, find those websites. When we come back, being a freshman, he says the very first thing you should do is introduce yourself to a student advisor and ask them the three biggest mistakes they made freshman year. That could be a long conversation. Much more with Rob Miller when we come back. Also later in the program, a report from the UN on attempts to come up with a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. That's still ahead as well. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Now, and we're speaking with Robert H. Miller. His new book, his new very big book, is Campus Confidential, The Complete Guide to the College Experience by Students, for Students, all sorts of advice about college. And earlier, Rob, we were talking about the admissions process, paying for school. Now, let's say you've got your funding, you're in, and you're in your freshman year. You say it's vital that in that first year you ask people three important questions. That's right?
Yeah, I think there are three questions to ask, and you really ought to be asking these questions of everyone you know who's been through college or at least been through freshman year. But those three questions are, the first one, what are the three biggest mistakes you made during your freshman year? How could you have avoided them, and what did you learn from them? The second question, what are the three best decisions or choices you made during your freshman year? and why are they considered to be good decisions? And the third, what are the three most important things you learned? And what these questions do for you is they boil down to a very tight essence what the most common mistakes and best little nuggets of wisdom are about how to undertake your freshman year. And you get different answers when you ask different people, but it's just a way to kind of put a magnifying glass on the experience and really hone in on how to avoid the major traps, how to make a couple of really good decisions that will help you out, and to learn a little bit from the people who've gone before so that you don't make the same mistakes that they made.
You know what I loved about that? It also really focuses attention on something that most people don't learn until they're way out of college, which is you don't know everything.
Well, you know, Robin, that actually puts its finger on the essence of what this book is all about. And there were a lot of naysayers when we started to put this project together. A lot of people said, geez, you know, college students don't need a book like this. They want to just float in the sea and kind of experience everything. And, you know, I'm all for that. But here's the thing. You know, you have 4 years in college. It's one of the most amazing experiences you'll have in your entire life. And why waste a year of that experience figuring out how many classes you should take, or the fact that you shouldn't get overburdened by extracurricular activities, or how to get along with your roommates? I mean, why not spend your energy and your time, you know, milking the experience for the very most you can get out of it, and putting your energy into forwarding your goals and your aspirations rather than figuring out the nuts and bolts of things that we can teach you.
Yeah. Oh, I wish I'd had this.
Me too.
moving on to 11 things to do right after you arrive on campus. Some of them seem simple, like get your ID card, get your computer, internet, email, telephone services, introduce yourself to resident advisors, get your mailbox key. But I love this one. Find a quiet, out-of-the-way place to study.
One of the most important things that I learned during my freshman year is that you really kind of need to segregate your time. There's so much going on the college campus that you could spend all of your time studying and miss 90% of the college experience, which we certainly don't want you to do. But you could also spend 100% of your time on the social aspects of the experience and end up being asked to leave because you don't meet the academic standards.
Right.
So the key here is finding a balance, and that is setting up a schedule so that when you're studying, you're studying, and when you're not studying, you can be completely free to drink in the social aspects of the experience without being burdened by the stress of, gee, I really should be studying. And one of the keys to that is getting away so that when it's time to read or it's time to do that organic chemistry problem set, you can concentrate and you're not burdened by friends coming up and asking you to go on a study break or, you know, flirting with people that are around you or sort of being disturbed by various things around. Finding somewhere quiet, out of the way, where you can just go and study.
That's just one piece of advice that Rob Miller has put together with a team of mentors. And I love the part where the students really get in their advice. And that brings us to don't go to college looking for love. As a freshman, when you come in, that should not be a priority. One of your mentors obviously thought that was really important to say.
The whole aspect of romance is a really interesting one, and one that we could talk about for the whole hour if we wanted to. You know, we encourage in the book a very healthy socialization during the first year. Get yourself acclimated. Get yourself situated. Meet new friends. Meet new people. Figure out where you're going with your life. You really need to figure out who you are first before you can start spending energy on who someone else is and what their needs are. It's not to say that you shouldn't get in a relationship if it feels right, but it's a cautionary tale. It just says, watch out. You know, don't just jump into the first relationship that seems comfortable, because if you do that, you will miss out on the bonding that goes on between social groups at the beginning of school. If you've bonded with one person and you spend a lot of time and energy on one person, you miss the larger socialization that's going on. And that's kind of what we were trying to point out, is there's time for relationships later. Spend at least the first semester of your freshman year getting yourself accustomed to the new experience.
And developing management strategies. I mean, that is a terrific chapter on, you know, teaching young people how to manage your life before it snowballs. There's another chapter on how to handle crises, anything from help, my college just cut my major, to, you know, I have a family emergency, what do I do? But then you come to transition years. When you advise that students who are now older, sophomores, juniors, really start thinking about goals, and just want to touch on this idea of having a stream of consciousness and writing your goals, what's that?
You know, Robin, this is something that I got into many years ago, actually right at the end of college when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I learned that when you sit down and you really think about your life and you start charting out some goals and you put them on paper and you think about them and start to organize them in order of priority, you really start to get some clarity on what's important to you.
What are your social goals, your extracurricular goals, your physical goals, your spiritual goals, your financial goals? And at the end of the chapter, resource reading. And again, the question comes up, though, Rob, is this just too much for young people to do who are also carrying a, you know, study load? Is this just a little bit too much self-work?
I don't think so. I think what this does is it really teaches people how to study smart rather than studying hard. Studying hard doesn't get the job done if your ladder's up against the wrong wall. And that's what that's about. It's about positioning the ladder first and then, by all means, start climbing and climb with whatever energy you can muster. But know where you're going before you start going. And that's what the goal setting piece is about.
Rob Miller, a graduate of Yale University and Pennsylvania Law School, an attorney in Manchester, New Hampshire, author in the past of The Law School Confidential, Business School Confidential, Med School Confidential, his new book, Campus Confidential, The Complete Guide to the College Experience by Students for Students. Rob, thanks so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And don't forget, still to come later in the program, columnist Art Buchwald. Much more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes despite a flurry of phone calls and meetings. It's slow going for a diplomatic ceasefire in Lebanon and no let up in violence there. Lebanon's prime minister repeatedly broke down in tears at a meeting of Arab foreign ministers in Beirut today when he described an Israeli airstrike in the southern village of Hula, which he at first thought killed 40 Lebanese, but it turned out left one person dead. Arab leaders who sympathetically applauded the prime minister have been unable to reach common ground on stopping the violence, but they are sending a delegation to the UN to object to a ceasefire resolution floated by the U.S. and France over the weekend. President Bush noted that disappointment, speaking to reporters at his ranch in Crawford, Texas today, saying he knows not everyone agrees with the resolution, but it's a first step.
Everyone wants the violence to stop. People are understand that there needs to be a cessation of hostilities in order for us to address the root causes of the problem.
Joining us now from the United Nations is reporter Linda Fasulo. And Linda, I understand you just came from a briefing. What's the pace of discussions?
Well, what's happening is actually I think there's a little bit of a delay in terms of when the expected action could take place. One thing, though, I want to make clear is that discussions are ongoing. That's all going. That's a given.
And when you say delay, I mean, what is there a time frame? Is there some at least speculation?
Well, you know, there is a sense that obviously the United States and France and other Security Council members want to move this as quickly as possible. There was talk of a possible vote tomorrow. But now what's happened is the Security Council will be holding an open meeting on this issue, basically to accommodate the three Arab foreign ministers who are coming to town to, you know, make the case for Lebanon. And so the council will be having this meeting in the afternoon tomorrow, which means that the earliest you could possibly then have a vote on a resolution would be Wednesday.
Well, the plan that's floating calls for an immediate ceasefire from Hezbollah and an end to Israeli offensive but not defensive attacks. We understand the Lebanese government has its own plan, which includes a prisoner swap and a demand that Israel withdraw. Is it likely that that could make it into the UN resolution?
I don't think it's very likely that the Security Council is going to change and call for an immediate ceasefire and an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, which means that Israel would not have the right of self-defense. The United States and France, even just a few minutes ago, were making it clear that they're pretty happy with the resolution. And interestingly, so is Russia. Russia is directing Lebanon to take a better look at the resolution, that there's a lot in it for them. So I think that the basic contours of the resolution are not going to change dramatically. And some of the changes that the Lebanese and Arab states on their behalf want are really non-starters. One is that the call for Israeli forces to pull out of Lebanon basically immediately, and when the fighting stops, and for the UN peacekeepers currently there, you know, there's a very small 2,000 member force
those,
there.
So those will be rejected, as you said. Linda Fasulo, covering the United Nations in New York. Linda, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, we now turn to Robert Pape. He's professor of political science at the University of Chicago and author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. And, Professor, you've written recently that Israel, and by extension the U.S., doesn't understand the nature of Hezbollah, that contrary to the conventional wisdom, it's not an Islamist militia or a political party. Why do you think that?
Hezbollah is not mainly a religious cult, as it's often painted, but a broad grassroots movement that was created by Israel's last major invasion of Lebanon.
Well, to be clear, created in reaction to the invasion.
That's right. At first, Hezbollah was just a small group of Shia supported by Iran. However, as more and more Shia came to resent and resist Israel's occupation, Hezbollah expanded, and it expanded into a loose collection of groups with a variety of religious and secular aims.
As you write, Hezbollah conducted a broad campaign of suicide bombings against Israeli, but also American and French targets. We, of course, remember the Marine barracks in 1983. And you studied those, 41 suicide attacks. What did you find?
Well, from 1982 to 1986, 41 suicide attackers killed themselves to carry out attacks for Hezbollah. Of those 41, only 8 are Islamic fundamentalists. 27 are communists or socialists from groups such as the Lebanese Communist Party, the Lebanese National Resistance Front, and the Arab Socialist Union. 3 were Christians. 1 was a Christian high school teacher with a BA.
And your conclusion that it's this varied a group?
What Lebanon's suicide attackers share is not an ideology or organizational indoctrination, but simply a common commitment to resist a foreign occupation.
But, Professor Pape, the group has grown since then, moved away from suicide bombings, and also since then, Christian and Muslim militias in Lebanon fought a bitter civil war. Doesn't that change the makeup of Hezbollah?
You see, when the occupation forces left southern Lebanon, what that did is it caused that loose collection of groups that supported Hezbollah to fracture and to start to fight each other. And now that Israeli forces are again attacking and occupying chunks of Lebanon, those groups which were fighting each other are now unifying and coming together. And you can see that by the Lebanese government, which had been no supporter of Hezbollah, by the Lebanese government support for Hezbollah now. And in fact, the longer Israeli forces stay occupying chunks of Lebanese territory, the more secular and various religious Lebanese are likely to resist that occupation.
Well, you say because of this, Israel can't win militarily against Hezbollah. What about the goal of defanging them?
Well, that defanging them by going in with ground troops and somehow rooting out Hezbollah is probably not going to work and just make Hezbollah stronger. A better approach would be to focus on the acquisition of missiles that are coming into Lebanon through Syria. And if we would adopt a major diplomatic effort to break Syria away from its increasing alliance with Iran, then, in fact, we might be able to convince Syria to stop allowing the flow of missiles over its territory into Lebanon. And if we achieve that goal, which I think is realistic, I think that that would substantially improve Israel's security.
What would be Syria's motivation for doing that?
Well, we're not going to be able to simply threaten Syria. That's what we're doing now, and that's only having the effect of driving Syria closer into the arms of Iran. What we should do is use a combination of carrots and sticks, and it shouldn't even be mainly an American initiative, although we can help. If you'll remember, several weeks ago, moderate Arab governments, Egypt, Jordan, were condemning Hezbollah. Well, in fact, we have squandered that initial support, and what we should offer Syria is, as the United States, is to begin serious negotiations over the Golan Heights. That's something Iran can't offer Syria, but we can.
Robert Pape is professor of political science at the University of Chicago, author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. We've asked him his opinion of the situation in the Middle East. Professor Pape, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Psychiatrist Jean Baker Miller, whose 1976 book, Toward a New Psychology of Women, is credited with altering the course of gender psychology, died at her home in Brookline, Massachusetts this past Saturday. A longtime teacher at Wellesley College, Dr. Baker Miller founded a training center to advance the study of what she called relational psychology. Dr. Judith Jordan, a longtime colleague, is now director of that program. Dr. Jordan, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
No, it's a big loss for everyone at Wellesley, but help us understand why. What is relational psychology? What was new about Jean Baker Miller's thinking?
Well, you know, the traditional psychology put the self at the center and the individual at the center, and Jean and her colleagues began to question that and say, you know, what really seems to be at the center of people's lives is their relationships and their need to connect with others, particularly women. Women were seen as weak, too emotional, too needy. And Jean began to look at the ways in which many of these traditional characteristics were actually strengths, that women were emotionally responsive and are very invested in building relationships and paying attention to the needs of others. And Jean began to talk about that as a strength of women and also as characteristics that all of us, the whole human race, needs more of.
The Los Angeles Times writes in their obituary that Jean Baker Miller began to use words such as connection, caring, and relationship instead of the negative words that had been used previously, dependency, manipulation, fusion.
Exactly.
She herself had a few obstacles in her own life. Can we just tell a little bit about where she came from? Because we know she was born into a working class family in the Bronx, contracted polio.
Yeah.
Which how did those things impact her later work?
You know, I think they gave her a tremendous sense of compassion. She, in addition to being a psychiatrist, Jean was tremendously concerned with social injustice and inequalities. She wrote a lot about how power really distorts relationships, how exclusion injures people. So I think a lot of those early hardships that she endured really built a sense of compassion and empathy for people who are marginalized and who are struggling.
And she one of the very few women in her field when she first started. And we understand that one of the things that she and her colleagues, including Dr. Irene Stiver, and yourself, one of the things that evolved was a warmer relationship between a therapist and a patient?
Yes. At the time that we were all trained, there was a lot of emphasis on being distant, being objective. And Jean's and all of our emphasis in therapy is to be more responsive, more present, more authentic, and really to talk about the fact that growth occurs in a mutual relationship.
But as you well know, there's also been criticism of Jean Baker Miller and her thinking about women in particular, that singling women out for special consideration makes it harder for them to be equals, that the notion that girls suffer a dramatic loss of self-esteem at adolescence, that there's been research that's sort of been questioning that. How did she respond to criticism of her work?
Jean knew that there would be criticism, and I think she had a sense of perspective and she had a sense of humor, and she did have an unquestioning and abiding belief and vision that this work made sense. And, you know, one of the interesting things, Robin, is that this work started 30 years ago, and really just in the last 5 years, the whole field of neuroscience is really seeing that the brain grows in connection, that we are hardwired to connect, that when we don't connect in an empathic way, that the brain suffers and is injured. So many of her early insights are really being validated now by very hard science. But, you know, Jean understood that this was a theory that wasn't going to be popular. She believed, as she said to Chris Robb, who wrote a book on this work, and Carol Gilligan's work and Judy Herman's work, she turned to Chris at one point in an interview, and she said, you know, Chris, this changes everything. And she believed that.
Dr. Judith Jordan, director of the Jean Baker Miller Training Institute at Wellesley College, speaking about Jean Baker Miller, who some say changed completely the way women are viewed in psychology. Jean Baker Miller died on Saturday at 78. Dr. Jordan, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
And stay with us. Art Buchwald is ahead, here and now. Now. This quick news note from his ranch in Crawford, Texas, President Bush says he hopes Cuba takes a turn towards democracy, but that it's up to the people in Cuba to decide, not exiles here in the U.S. The president's statement comes as Fidel Castro has been out of sight since July 31st, when his secretary announced Castro had temporarily ceded power to his younger brother Raul and had undergone surgery. Castro supporter Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, said on his weekly radio program that Castro is doing well, getting out of bed, and talking more than he should. Because he talks a lot, Chavez said. To Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, which is famous for a lot of things, beautiful beaches, good fishing, and for being the summer home of Art Buchwald, who's there now to his surprise. His column won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. He hobnobs with the D.C. elite and pokes fun of them as well. But earlier this year, Art Buchwald checked into a hospice expecting to die and then didn't. And Art Buchwald joins us now on the line from Martha's Vineyard. Hello.
Thank you very much.
Boy, thank you. I mean,
I'm a celebrity for death.
Well, sort of.
Because I had my leg amputated, and then I wouldn't take dialysis for my kidney. I went to the hospices, and I was expecting to go in about 2 or 3 weeks. So that was 6 months ago.
Yeah, what happened?
Nobody knows. But what happened was, while I was there, and I figured, well, I got nothing to do, I write my column while I was there. So I wrote my column and dictated to my assistant. Mm-hmm. And then, about 3 months into my hospice, I said to the doctor, hey, what's my chances? He said, they're very good. Why don't you get a leg? So I got a leg, and then somebody said, well, if you got a leg, what are you going to do now? I said, well, if I can't go to heaven, I'll go to Martha's Vineyard.
Sort of the same, some would say.
And Martha's Vineyard is some sort of heaven.
We understand you said, this is reported in the Boston Globe, you said your plan when you went to the hospice was to leave this earth, then you thought to hell with it.
Yeah.
And enjoy the good earth on Martha's Vineyard. You know, Art Buchwald, I have this memory of long ago. You were sort of the self-appointed unofficial tour guide of the Martha's Vineyard Bluffs. And I was out there once with you, and it was completely, the fog had rolled in. It was sort of raining. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And I think you had a broken leg. And you were determined to give a tour to a bunch of non-English-speaking Japanese tourists. So they couldn't see anything, and they couldn't understand you, and you still gave them this tour. And I've thought of that a lot over the last year, thinking of you, that I'm wondering if that need to be, you know, of service to people, important to people, you know, playing some role with people, played a part in your getting out of that hospice.
Yeah.
Yeah?
What was the question?
I think that was it.
Yeah.
We understand that a lot of people came to see you in the hospice, and I'm just wondering if it reminded you of how much you're loved and maybe too soon to go.
Yeah, isn't that great? I could actually get all this love and still hear it and feel it.
Right.
And if I was dead, I wouldn't get all that. So I wrote this book now, which is called Too Soon to Say Goodbye.
Right. We understand that in the book you're including eulogies that were written but not delivered.
That's right.
From who?
My daughter, my son, and Mike Wallace, and Tom Brokaw. It was going to be a funeral, and now it's a celebration.
And a book.
And I got a book out of it.
Death is
something that people don't like to talk about. When they can talk about it, it's something different. So what
are they saying about it? I mean, I remember, of course, a lot of people know that you and Mike Wallace and William Styron all famously helped each other through bouts of depression. Are you all talking now about death?
No. Well, Bill Styron is having a lot of trouble. It can be talked about because people open up.
Yeah.
Because I was there in the hospice, so they figured it's okay to talk about death.
Yeah.
But you don't talk about it with your family, your children, or nothing.
Yeah.
Until something like this happens. And the main thrust of everything is you have to die. There's no way that you can avoid dying. There's the bottom line.
What did people say about you in the eulogies? What are some of the things they said?
Oh, they're very great. It's lovely to hear or read it. And Mike Wallace claimed I was a fraud, that I just went into the hospital so I could have a chance to make some money. Tom Brokaw wrote a funny piece. When I asked them to do it, they said, oh, yeah. And at the beginning, they thought they'd do it in a joke form.
Yeah.
But then when they did it, it wasn't a joke. They were very sweet.
Well, Art Buchwald, one of our favorite columns of yours is the annual Thanksgiving column.
Yes.
In which you explain Thanksgiving to the French.
Yes.
In fact, we'll put it on our website so people can read it. But do you, I mean, I'm thinking ahead. I'm wondering, do you think ahead? Do you think,
this is the important thing. When I made my decision to not take dialysis, that meant I could relax because I'm going to die, so I don't have to make any plans. Then what happened is when I didn't die, I had to make plans. I had to shave again. And I had to deal with Bush again. So it's an interesting thing. I have to deal with the reality now. But when I agreed not to go to heaven, it was a whole different ballgame.
Right. Right. Now you got to make yourself useful while here.
Yeah, so I came up here and I'm doing the auction for Possible Dreams, and the purpose of it is to raise money for all the things in the island, like daycare centers, like children under drug stuff.
Right.
There are 15,000 people on the Vineyard in the winter. And there were 150,000 in the summer. So the purpose of the auction is to get the summer people to raise money so that the people in the winter can get help.
Okay. Well, it's a terrific thing that you do there and elsewhere, and we're going to let you go to do more of it. And I'm just personally glad we had a chance to say hi.
Yeah, let's say hi again.
Okay.
Goodbye, sweetheart.
Take care. newspaper columnist Art Buchwald. For more on the Possible Dreams auction, he'll be the auctioneer, and it gets underway today on Martha's Vineyard. Go to our website, here-now.org. And here, we briefly considered playing that great Cape Cod bar tune, How Can We Miss You When You Don't Go Away, because we know he would have loved it, but we refrain. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.